Hello, my name is Andy Bombeck, and welcome to another Mojo Music, where I'll be reading articles from Mojo Magazine, along with playing snippets of music. Please let Sun Sounds Radio know if you enjoyed today's program, or how it could be improved. Okay, as I mentioned last week, I'm going to continue reading articles from the April 2026 issue of Mojo Magazine. I'm going to finish the article that I started last week about Miles Davis, and then 50 years ago, 1976, 10 key moments in punk rock history. And then a classic album review of Maggot Brain by Funkadelic. Okay, the article that I started last week about Miles Davis is titled Miles at 100, Man in Motion. Miles Davis, who would have been 100 this May 26th, was never content with his stellar achievements or his place in the world. Defiant in the face of racism, uncompromising in his quest for perfection, blazing a trail for new sounds, champion wave after wave of young musicians. He embodied the idea of progress in music, and today, over 30 years since his passing, still does. And this is where I left off last week, Miles, 1968 to 1975, Electric Dreams. Davis's most startling and controversial transformation into the dark wizard of interstellar post-jazz. Davis had been experimenting with the new sonorities of electric instruments on 1968's Miles in the Sky and Flies de Kilimanjaro. And thanks to the influence of his new wife, Betty Mabry, later Betty Davis, he had also begun checking out black, rock, and funk artists, including Jimi Hendrix, Sly Stone, and James Brown, alongside the tape manipulation of Carlson's Stockhausen. Yet the music laid down in that February 1969 session had more in common with the spare, enigmatic abstractions of 1967's Miles Smiles, edited by producer Teo Maceo, to make two side long suites. It represented late 60s jazz in a state of hypnotic ambient abstraction. Davis called it In a Silent Way. Through his relationships with Mabry, Marguerite Eskridge, and Jackie Battle, Davis was rebuilding himself. He stopped smoking and immersed himself in Zen philosophy and Indian ragas, music that, along with a minimalism of late 60s, James Brown told him to listen to what I can leave out, the silences between the notes. The approach would bear fruit in August 1969 sessions, starring a radical 12-piece lineup including Wayne Shorter, soprano sax, John McLaughlin, electric guitar, two electric keyboardists, Joe Zwisnell and Larry Young, and critically, Benny Maupin's eerie bass clarinet. Coupled with Dave Holland's switch to electric bass and third keyboardist Chick Corea's decision to run his Fender Rhodes through an Oberheim ring modulator and Echoplex tape delay, the result was a radical, otherworldly sound, weird, heavy, and discordantly futuristic. Davis's title alarmed those around him. Miles just called and said he wants this album to be titled Bitches Brew. Please advise, ran Teo Maceo's panicked memorandum to CBS, so did the music, a double LP of dark, trance-like rock grooves and howling high-register solos over low and electronic textures and hypnotic pedal drones. There's a title track from that album, Bitches Brew, by Miles Davis. Bitches Brew was both a badass sound for difficult times and a blueprint for the future. Jazz clubs were closing, and with one eye on a rapidly evolving pop culture, Columbia CBS president Clive Davis contacted West Coast rock impresario Bill Graham, telling him Miles is breaking out of his jazz bag. The underground is ready for him. Graham booked Davis for a four-night run at the Fillmore West in April 1970, co-headlining with the Grateful Dead. That saw Davis and his group testing the limits of amplified stadium sound with a magnified, frenetic performance of vivid, churning glory. Other U.S. states followed, in Central Park and Madison Square Garden, but arguably the landmark gig was on a blistering, hot, late August afternoon in 1970 when Davis took the stage at the Isle of Wight Festival in front of 600,000 spectators with an expanded outfit of Korea Holland, 29-year-old saxophonist Gary Bartz, keyboardist Keith Jarrett, percussionist Artio Murillo, and drummer Jack DeJohnette. In the pristine footage on YouTube, you see a group walking a dangerous, delicate line between hairy-free exploration and modal funk rigor. Watching Davis prowl the rear of the stage, listening to his band transmute the joy and chaos of the day into a squealing spiral of mood-altering dissonance, is to see an artist utterly at ease in the eye of a storm, aware that he is orchestrating, in fact, a new kind of order. On record, working with Maceo, Davis began to transform these chaotic, in-the-moment jams into cohesive suites of sound. Out of 11 guitar-heavy sessions at 30th Street Studio in early 1970, the pair hewed two side-long tracks of pulmonating funk blues abstraction that would be released as a soundtrack for a documentary about America's first black heavyweight boxing champion, Jack Johnson. Davis himself began to focus on boxing as a means of keeping fit, and in an interview, he would discuss his fitness regimen and diet of soybean salads, vegetable broth, and fruit, saying, "If horses can eat green shit and be strong and run like motherfuckers, why shouldn't I?" The fitness manifested itself in the music, 1972 LP On the Corner, initially dismissed by Davis's own biographer, Bill Coleman, as an insult to the intellect of the people, can now be heard as the wiry conceptual masterpiece it always was, a dense muscular work that references West African ritual dances, rich Indian drones, shrill, cacophonious funk, and aggressive urban squall to recreate the multicultural sounds of a New York City street. Even albums once dubbed obligational redundances contained startling passages of genius. Take the haunting ambient sound suite Great Expectations and the can-like alien blues of Go Ahead John, both on 1974's Big Fun. Here's a little bit of that song, Go Ahead John, by Miles Davis. But despite the focus on his physical health, a kind of long-distance entropy was catching up with Davis. After recording On the Corner, he was rushed to the hospital with gallstones, and that October, he crashed his car into a traffic island on Manhattan's West Side Highway, resulting in two broken legs and a reliance on morphine that would prove to be his undoing. Denied his fast cars, the recklessness moved into his music, and the Davis Live Act sailed ever closer to a point of baffling and beautiful self-immolation. Meanwhile, Miles on Record was reaching toward a point of polyrhythmic dub, minimalism, and on the 32-minute Duke Ellington tribute, He Loved Him Madly, on 1974's Get Up With It, a kind of glacial Floridian flow, with hindsight both the onstage miles and studio miles seem to be heading toward a terminal stage, one in a blaze of white phosphorescent noise and the other in a quiet, unstructured fade to deep space blackness. It's part of the song He Loved Him Madly by Miles Davis. In both Agartha and Pangaea, that those two endpoints can be heard most vividly. They are documents of a genius flying too close to the sun. The simultaneous sound of escape velocity, structural damage, and the downward pull of gravity. On reflection, it seems inevitable that Davis would surrender to it, at least for a while. Miles, 1975 to 1991, back in the ring. After a dizzying and depressing descent, Hal Davis clawed his way back into contention and perhaps redemption. Miles Davis was conspicuous in his absence, off the road and out of sight for more than 6 months, since the late summer of 1975, when he turned up at Columbia Studios in New York for a day of recording, March 30th, 1976, according to one sessionography. Davis biographer Jack Chambers claimed it was sometime in May. No matter, nothing much got done. The band, including Electric Phase veterans Pete Casey on guitar, bassist Michael Henderson, and drummer Al Foster, ran down three numbers, one, a Davis co-write, Song of Landia, with saxophonist Sam Morrison. Davis did not pick up his trumpet. He conducted and played the organ, said Teo Maciro. The trumpet was there. He just didn't feel like playing the trumpet. Davis did not lead another serious recording date or come back to his horn with any heart or purpose for 4 years. I'm through. I can't play. Davis, about to turn 50, growled to Rolling Stone in an interview that noted his serial health crisis, an ulcer, pneumonia, an implant to ease his chronic hip pain. Then he stepped back from the brink. I can think of a lot of things to do, man. That'd be great, acknowledging rumors of a collaboration with Gil Evans on the Pucci opera Tosca. Davis also hoped the hip operation meant he could tour a few times each year. He chose exile instead, a blackout of NUI and hard drug use in his Manhattan townhouse on West 77th Street. That block is now Miles Davis Way. Davis boasted in his autobiography that he spent up to $500 a day on cocaine and fucked all the women I could, until the actress Cicely Tyson, an on-off girlfriend since 1966, shook him straight. They married in 1981 and split in 1987 over Davis's continued infidelities. Davis's past refused to stay there. Mentors and sidemen from every era came around to offer support, among them Evans, Charlie Parker bandmate Max Roach, and Bitches Brew drummer Jack DeJohnette. Although Davis didn't always open the door, Columbia sent checks despite the void of product, ensuring some payback by issuing archival material from the studio, 1976's Water Babies, 1979's Circle in the Round, and The Stage. A 1977 Japanese release, Dark Magus, was two sets of heavy, abstract turbulence from Carnegie Hall in March 1974. Like it or not, Miles Davis was, before his illness, playing music which perfectly reflected its time. Richard Williams wrote in a Melody Maker review, "When eventually he returns to public performances, I venture to suggest that it will be with a music modified yet again." One incident in 1979 showed Davis reaching out in his way. During a marathon broadcast of his Canon on the Columbia University radio station WKCR, Davis phoned the studio and for 2 hours dictated to DJ and jazz scholar Phil Schopp, one of the hosts, his onomopoetic listings of the correct names and titles of his albums that had only come out in Japan up to that point. As Schopp put it, he said, "You got it? Yes, Mr. Davis, good. Play Sketches of Spain right now." Coaxed back to recording by Columbia A&R executive George Butler, Davis was hardly match fit for 1981's The Man with the Horn, or his first round of live work in 6 years, where his LPs once declared Directions in Music by Miles Davis on the cover, he reemerged an intermittent force in fragile health, soloing with tentative chops through an uneven repertoire of hard funk vamps and pop soul gloss, epitomized by that album's title ballad, a cloying vocal horrific on which Davis played like a legend diminished, just passing through. Davis summed up his last years at Columbia to New Musical Express in 1985, coldly dismissing Butler's burgeoning shit. The trumpeter was more present on 1984's Decoy, loading it with synthesizers in the wake of his ex-pianist Herbie Hancock's electro scratch smash Rocket. Then he extended the Great American Songbook by covering, to enduring effect, two recent pop hits, Cyndi Lauper's Time After Time and Michael Jackson's Human Nature, for 1985's You're Under Arrest, with more restraint in the trimmings and tender pinpoint care in his Variations. "You have to play the right thing," Davis said in that NME interview, "and the right thing is around the melody. I learned that stuff from Coleman Hawkins." Coleman could play a melody, get ad-libs, run the chords, and you still heard the melody. Hawkins' bebop blueprint, 1939's Body and Soul, in a nutshell. Tutu, His 1986 Warner Brothers debut was Davis's most thorough immersion to date in state-of-the-art R&B, and the first time he delegated so much authority to a sideman, Marcus Miller, Davis's bassist from 1981 to 1983. Wrote, co-produced, and programmed nearly all of the stark modernism framing Davis's terse, spearing phrases and dancing obligatos. Then did it again on the 1987 film soundtrack, Music from Siesta. "I don't lead musicians, man, they lead me," Davis clarified at the time. "I listen to them to learn what they can do best, feeding it back to them." His bands, in the last decade, faced impossible expectations set by the great quintets and electric armadas. Yet jazz, as those groups forged, changed agents in jazz, rock, and the fissures between them. From Wayne Shorter and Chick Corea to future pop producers Reggie Lewis and Muldoon, Davis sired a new line of virtuosos in Miller, guitarist Mike Stern, and John Scofield, saxophonist Kenny Garrett, and future Rolling Stones bassist Daryl Jones. He knew, whatever the configuration, what to get out of the guys. Vince Wilburn Jr., Davis's nephew and drummer in the 1980s, recalled to me in 2016. People would go, "Oh, you guys play pop tunes, like Skritti Politti's Perfect Way." But that was his direction, and he wanted saxophonist Bob Berg, Sco, and Stern. Those cats played outside the box of the pop tunes. Davis worked to the very end, summoning his best in valedictory laps. Mr. Pistorius was a lyrical eulogy for the Weather Report bassist on 1989's Armada. And he was surprisingly busy as a guest star, contributing to records by Cameo, Chaka Khan, and, in further admiration, Skritti Politti. If not a walk in the park, he makes Lou Reed look like a pussycat, Steve Van Zandt observed after Davis appeared on his 1985 All-Star Protest LP, Sun City. The artist who swore he never looked back ultimately could not help himself, reprising fragments of In a Silent Way, theme from Jack Johnson, and So What in Performance, the last during Davis's only face-to-face performance with Prince, the encore of a 1987 New Year's Eve bash at the Paisley Park compound. Then, on July 8, 1991, Davis went all the way, persuaded by producer Quincy Jones to revisit the Gil Evans Suites, Miles Ahead, Porky and Bess, and Sketches of Spain, in Evans' memory of the Montreux Jazz Festival. Davis was in dire physical shape in rehearsals. Trumpeter Wallace Roney, an avowed discipline, played many of Davis's parts, but on the day, released in 1993 as Miles and Quincy Live at Montreux, Davis, said Romney, went for it and didn't flinch. Afterwards, Jones saw Davis actually smile at the audience and wave. He said, "Let's take this all over the world, man." On September the 28th, Davis died at 65 in a Santa Monica hospital, his ravaged body finally surrendering to pneumonia and a stroke. In a 1988 interview, jazz writer Gene Santoro had asked Davis to summarize his first four decades in music. "Well, I didn't realize what I did," he responded, "until I came back to play in 1991. And there were all these books. He did this and that and that. sounds like Columbus, he cracked. What I did, I was gonna do that anyway. Know what I mean? Besides, we did it, Davis added, emphasizing the plural. Everyone in his story. I didn't do it by myself. I'm moving on to the article, 10 Key Moments in Punk Rock History. And this is titled Punk at 50, State of Shock. British punk rock moved fast in its first 12 months, fueled by Sex Pistols shows that challenged pop music norms and advertised by photographs that screamed their satirical and attitudinal provocations. 50 years on, John Savage selects 10 key moments from the banner year of 1976 and the picture that froze them in amber. There was a powerful sense of being present, he recalls. You can do it, and whatever you're going to do, do it now. For the records, there was the press. Extremely competitive, the weekly British music press prided itself on being there before anyone else. In the NME issue of November the 8th, 1975, Charles Shar Murray told you all you needed to know about the Ramones. And it was as much about the look as the music. Black leather jacket, torn jeans, sneakers. This would become the standard punk uniform that spread through the UK after early 1977. Before this uniform were the Sex Pistols. For the first half of 1976, they were by themselves trailblazers for a very small but very committed youth subculture. They were heavily styled by Malcolm McLaren and Vivian Westwood. After all, it was McLaren's opportunistic idea to have the group model clothes from the pair's Sex Euphorium at 430 King's Road. And if that wasn't enough, frontman Johnny Rotten had a unique and eye-catching fashion sense. Whether it was destroyed school blazers, striped zoot suit trousers, or a tiny, totally ripped red pullover. It was as much the look as the music that promoted London punk during 1976. The way the Sex Pistols modeled clothes, and that includes the sex designs that Steve Jones and Paul Cook wore, as well as Glenn Matlock's DIY paint spattered trousers, was the perfect visual accompaniment to the way they sounded and the reactions they deliberately provoked. Before a note was heard by most people, photographers were broadcasting this look through the NME Sounds and Melody Maker. Apart from Record Mirror, which had full-color front pages, the weekly music papers were all in black and white, well over 50 broadsheet pages to be filled every week. Whatever was going on or not going on, there was a lot of space for monochrome photographs, and a number of talented photographers filled the gap. Ray Stevenson, Joe Stevens, Caroline Kuhn, Kate Simon, Sheila Rock, Jill Formosky, Ian Dixon, Barry Plummer. Some of their images, whether documentary or posed, are reproduced here. While some of these photos were destined for the music press, others were taken for different reasons. P.T. Madden took a series of pictures in April 1976 as an art project, documenting a group he thought was about to split up. Others are simple documents shot with no immediate outlet. Phil Mason snaps of Buzzcocks at St. Boniface's Church Hall, summer 1976, Paul Welch's series at the Sex Pistols' first Lesser Free Trade concert in Manchester, John formerly Joan Ingham's photos of The Clash and Sex Pistols in November 1976, when everything was hotting up. Within a year of their first show, the Sex Pistols had done something extraordinary. They had a mirror standing in front of them all the time, remembered Al McDowell, who put on the group at the Central School of Arts on November the 7th, 1975. The media side of it was very well controlled. It was presented as a package all the time. Graphically, it was all together. Everything had an atmosphere. It was threatening, and it had that feeling of revolt. The group polarized audiences. There was a lot of incomprehension, rejection, and hostility returned. But there was also the opposite reaction. In the early 80s, Brian Eno stated that although the Velvet Underground and Nico had only sold 30,000 in the first few years after its March 1967 release, everyone who bought one of those 30,000 copies started a band. The same happened with the Sex Pistols in 1976. Furious energy that they unleashed as a total package of sound, look, lyrics, and performance styles encouraged scores of mavericks and outsiders to start a band, produce their own fanzine, begin designing their own clothes, and all the rest. The heightened intensity of their shows created a powerful sense of being present. You can do it. And whatever you're going to do, do it now. The gap between thinking and doing was reduced to almost nothing. This urgency would transform British pop culture during 1977 in ways which would render the original spirit almost unrecognizable. But that was in the future. In late autumn 1976, there was no certainty that punk, as it was then generally called, was going to work. Although record contracts were being offered, there was no guarantee of sales or impact. By the end of the year, there were several British punk groups up and rising: the Sex Pistols, the Clash, the Damned, Buzzcocks, Subway Sect, none of whom adhered to a satirical template. This individuality and creativity would soon disappear after the tabloid frenzy prompted by the Pistols' December 1 interview on Tim's TV Today show with Bill Grundy and the arrival of a flood of imitators. What the following pictures show is the groups and their audiences before they were fully defined by the media. When flares coexisted with straight legs, short cuts with long hair, scruffy hippie style leaching into the new sharp angles. In 1976, nothing was set as yet. 1. A tonsorial shock. Sex Pistols, London, August 13th, 14th, 1976. Posed in various street locations and simulating a performance in Notre Dame Hall, now the Leicester Square Theater, the Sex Pistols were caught at their satirical height in color by veteran Bravo photographer Wolfgang Bobby Heidelman. Some images were eventually published as a poster and in the magazine. In late September 1976, Bravo was essentially a teen pop magazine, and this fitted McLaren's original vision of the Sex Pistols as a kind of destroyed Bay City Rollers. Glenn Matlock is wearing a 60s mod red and black striped shirt, painted splattered trousers a la Jackson Pollock, and before the Clash used the look in later 1976. And red suede slingbacks. Steve Jones is wearing an Anarchy shirt, stenciled with the slogan, "Dangerously Close to Love," with straight leg jeans and bondage boots. Paul Cook has the infamous torn Pink Floyd t-shirt with "I Hate" written over the top. All have short hair. As the lead singer, John Lydon, steps up to the mark with a pair of silver and black zoot suit trousers, a round collar gray shirt with black tie, black brothel creepers, and an old pink braided school blazer festooned with badges, safety pins, and unpleasant messages, "Why are you a cunt?" on his wrist, a studded S&M bracelet. Unlike the others, his hair is short and spiked up, a tonsural shock to complement the aggression, still playful then, and provocation of his live performance. By mid-August, the group were well established as the brand leaders of the emerging movement that had yet no fully agreed name. Both The Clash and The Damned had played their first shows, both groups directly inspired and formed out of the same pool of aspirant musicians as the Sex Pistols. Their next couple of weeks brought shows around the country in Birmingham, West Rutton, and Nottingham before the punks returned to the high-profile Screen on the Green shown at the end of the month. Number two, a high-energy racket. Sex Pistols, Andrew Logan's Warehouse, London, February 14, 1976. One of the Sex Pistols' major early appearances was a Valentine's Day party held by artist Andrew Logan at his warehouse in Docklands. Photographer Joe Stevens was there, along with Vivienne Westwood, Malcolm McLaren, Sex employee Pamela Rook, a.k.a. Jordan, ex-NME writer Chrissy Hyde, photographer Kate Simon, future Clash guitarist Mick Jones. Artist-filmmaker Derek Jarman, who shot a couple of reels of the group on Super 8, the first footage to exist. It was a high-energy racket, Jarman later remembered. There were about 10 or 15 people there, and Jordan and Vivienne in the front row were egging them on and gobbling at them. "They certainly did a number on me and Katie and Chrissy," Joe Stevens recalled. We hadn't seen anything like that before. It was like the monkeys going mad, doing stepping stone. We couldn't figure out what the hell it was." Stevens took some memorable shots that night, including the incident where, encouraged by McLaren, the NMEs here, Johnny Rotten grabbed Jordan and barred her breast. As she remembered, he broke the zip on the back of his polo neck leotard and a pair of Manolo blanket shoes. Stevens, an American, had been at Woodstock and worked for the International Times, where he was known as Captain Snaps, before accompanying the McCartneys on the Wings Over Europe tour. In the mid-70s, he was working for the NME, where he was deathly bored by the then-current music scene. "I was going bananas. I was going to give it all up." The pictures he took that night caught the moment as McLaren desired. They were featured on the NME and in early Sex Pistols press releases, establishing a level of outrage. Opinion is divided as to whether the Logan Party constituted a clash of cultures, with the Sex Pistols disturbing an older generation. Most of the group had little truck with the Logan Milieu, a more established cohort of artist provocateurs who were, from most accounts, slightly alarmed, but also tolerant. "I think they liked it," Glenn Matlock told me. It was that arty crowd. They could see the funny side of it as well. The show was also mentioned in the Sex Pistols' first piece of national newspaper coverage, a photograph of Jordan in the Sunday Times that June. Number three, We're in Chaos. Sex Pistols, the Nashville, West London, April 3rd, 1976. A final year, graphic design student at the London College of Printage, P.T. Madden, saw the first Sex Pistols show at St. Martin's College of Art on November the 5th, 1975. When he saw them again, by accident, at the Marquee Show of February the 12th, he became totally obsessed. That was the gig when an irate French kid moaned, "But you can't play," and Glenn Matlock swaggered back with, "So what? I thought it was joyous." The third time he saw them was at the 100 Club at the end of March. That was the show when the group nearly split up after an onstage argument between Lydon and Matlock, prompted, Matlock remembers, by the group suggesting they cover Dave D, Doozy, Beaky, Mick and Titch's He's a Raver. As Lydon stormed off the stage and walked up the stairs to catch a bus mid-set, Steve Jones ripped all the strings off his guitar. As Madden remembers, "I thought, if they split up, I want something to remember them by, so I can recreate this experience." Inspired by the multi-frame tabloid of Ed Rush's and Andy Warhol, Madden took along a 35mm camera to the very next show that the Sex Pistols played at the Nashville in West Kensington on April the 3rd, reckoning that if they split up at that gig, I would have my photographic time travel machine. It was the Sex Pistols' second appearance at the venue, but they were not yet a draw, although they had a few press mentions, including Neil Spencer's review of their Marquee show, ended with the noted, "We're into chaos," quote. They had no advertisements, no major feature, no record company backing. They were still barely exposed. Positioning himself in front of the stage, Madden took two rolls at regular 30-second intervals, from which 26 frames eventually survived. They capture a raw but coherent group. There is a sharpness to their outlines, accentuated by the minimal backdrop and their striped fashions. Steve Jones runs through his guitar hero postures, while Matlock, it is plain to see, is the one to keep the group going, the motivator and the grounding force. But it is Rotten who catches the eye. Consistently in motion, constantly in motion, at one ancient and boyish, aggressive and unsure, stiff and highly animated. This was the show that convinced O. Strummer to leave the 101ers and eventually form The Clash. Madden's photographs lay untouched for nearly 40 years before being rediscovered and showcased at an exhibition at London's Wilkinson Gallery in 2016. He still sees them in artistic rather than rock business terms. "To me, they will always be the greatest art school band," he says, "and that they didn't seem to object to being styled, something most rock musicians detest." Number four, the world had changed. Now, this is where I'm going to have to stop with this article, but I will continue it next week. Now it's time for the classic album review, and this week it's the album Maggot Brain by Funkadelic, 1971. Eco-friendly funketeers marry psychedelic rock to a whacked-out soul groove. Back then, people said, you just can't do that sort of thing on a record, George, explains Clinton. And I was saying right back, you bet your ass I can. Funkadelic's previous two records, their self-titled debut, and its follow-up, Free Your Mind and Your Ass Will Follow, saw funk as the road to redemption and transcendental experience. Maggot Brain was no exception. With a screaming black woman's head rising out of the earth on the album sleeve, liner notes that quoted the teachings of the Process Church of Final Judgment, and eerie, foreboding lyrics that inform the listener, I have tasted the maggots in the mind of the universe. And I was not offended, for I knew I had to rise above it all, or drown in my own shit. Their third album was a frighteningly frazzled trip. 14 years on from his innocent beginnings as singer in doo-wop group The Parliaments, George Clinton was on a mission centered around LSD-inspired liberation and black consciousness and pride. Their fusion of the R&B of James Brown, Sly Stone, and Curtis Mayfield with trippy acid rock riffs finally hit pay dirt with this, their third offering, which confounded both critic and listeners, despite reaching number 14 in the U.S. R&B chart. Little is remembered about the actual recording sessions that gave birth to Maggot Brain. Clinton admits the album was produced while he was on acid. I just got in there and turned the knobs, Clinton said. It was such a vibe. I didn't know any better. You can only do that stuff when you don't know any better. Despite Clinton's unusual approach to producing, Maggot Brain successfully mixed political charged comment, Are You and Your Folks. Here's a little bit of that song, You and Your Folks, Me and My Folks. Wars of Armageddon dealt with the horrors of Vietnam, and here's a little bit of that song, Wars of Armageddon. Gospel music, can you get to that? Here's a little bit of that song. Mm-hmm. Cosmic Funk Rock Stomps, Super Stupid. Here's a little bit of Super Stupid. But the finest moment has to be the haunting, transcendental title track. Rumor has it that Clinton had discovered his brother's decomposed body lying in a Chicago apartment with a cracked skull, hence the maggot brain. And he locked guitarist Eddie Hazel alone in the studio with a brief to play Like Your Mother Just Died. Hazel did just that, producing an anguished, fragile, 9-minute guitar solo that rivaled Hendrix and was a world away from Funkadelic's next project, the more conventional funk sound, America Eats Its Young. And again, that's all the time that we have for today. Please join me next week when I continue reading articles from the April 2026 issue of Mojo Magazine. I'm going to finish the story I started today about punk rock 50 years ago, and then the passing of Bob Ware of the Grateful Dead, who left us November 2026. Classic album review of ELO's Time. Until then, this is Andy Bombeck for Mojo Music saying so long and keep rocking.